Hello, everybody. My name's James Bamfield, and this is the Spirituality for Today podcast. It's been a while, but I'm now back with a bang, you might say, because I'm here with a very special person, certainly very special in my life, and I think in many other people's lives that I know. And I'm here today with Genevieve Sophia Dow. Now, how to describe Genevieve, or Jen, as I usually call her? She is so many things; it would take a long time. But let's give it a go, because it's not just a polymath; it's a polydoer. I don't know what the right Greek is for that. Anyway, Jen is a poet, a writer, a philosopher. She is also a teacher of various physical mythosomatic movements, as she calls them. When I first learned them, it was called Qigong. She is also, as far as I remember, a martial arts expert, has been in the past and at a very high competitive level in Kung Fu. And she's also, amazingly enough, a blacksmith who specializes not only in, my language is going to fail me, my equestrian language, in shoeing, can I say that? Shoeing horses.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a very, very close connection in general to the equine world and horses. Have I covered everything there, do you think? More or less?
I think so. I think that's a good base, yes. Yeah. Hi, everyone.
And just to cover our history, so about 12 years ago, me and my family went to Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is where you still are, I believe.
Somewhere about, yes.
And I spent a year studying Qigong with Zhen as often as I could. That was also through one of my dearest and oldest friends, Thomas, who is one of your biggest students, I think, and who's also transmitted a lot of your work. And it's an incredibly fond memory I have of, I remember I felt incredibly slow learner. I think it took me a whole year really just to work out the morning medical, which is one of the original series of movements. But the fact is, I still do these movements every single day, or a combination of them. And I remember once, occasionally I miss it, you know, maybe a couple of times a year. And I remember once all I had, I was in the aeroplane and I just did them mentally in my head. And actually it worked incredibly well because I realized I hadn't done it that day for various reasons. And they're very dear to me, those movements. And I think the other big connection we have is that, you know, it, for me and my sort of academic upbringing, you know, and my spiritual life, which has kind of pretty much been, you know, my main priority since I was 16 or 17 years old, is to learn these spiritual mythosomatic movements. And at the same time, hearing you quote, you know, it was usually either Shakespeare or Heidegger or Emily Dickinson. You know, that's kind of heaven for me.
Oh, James.
Because that, you know, that's my different worlds, which I have not always been able to bring together. I would say a huge part of my intellectual, philosophical life remains in my own head and in the books that I read. So that was a very important part of it for me. And that's what partly why I'm fascinated to do this podcast now and see where our connection takes us.
Well, I should say for my part that you always brought, and still, even recently on the online class, you always brought an ebullient and collegial presence, even way back then. Mm-hmm. And that was nourishing to me always, because I really don't understand a student-teacher relationship in any large sense of the picture. In other words, when I look out at a class now, all I can think about is the kind of expertise that people have that I don't have, right? And you always brought, I don't want to say a sense of confidence, because that's kind of banal, but it was always collegial studying. That's an interesting slip. I was about to say studying with you. Isn't that interesting? It was always collegial having you as a quote student, because you brought your whole self and you rode the wind of those analogies, which I think are constant, those references, those allusions that you mentioned. And then I think that brings up a point, which is that you mentioned that initial series, and that was a series that was closest to traditional Qigong, that represents now probably about 2% of the work that I've created. And that series or form, depending on what you call it, did have direct references back to what we might call traditional Qigong movements. And that was the form that I actually used unconsciously to cajole myself out of standard types of Qigong movements. And the reason for that is directly related to the analogies or the allusions that you just made, which is artists and poetry. And I began to mythopoeticize, to theatricalize, to gesturalize, to use the word Qigong without even knowing it as a way to theatricalize the soul and to make stories and to make emotional life as movement and ontological experiences that had nothing to do with the basic medicinal principles of what we commonly know as Qigong. And that's right. why, you know, I call the work, the physical work, the mythosomatic movement or mythosomatics, because that's what it is. It's me as a theater director, as a physical theater director, innovating movements that come out of my body and my psyche and attempt to represent stories that the soul tells. And what's interesting, James, is that every single form, and I'm going to use the word form to describe the individual movements and series to describe the larger forms of those movements, every single form that I've ever innovated or created comes from a kind of spiritual crisis. And I use the word crisis fondly, by which I mean an intersection of an impasse in which my body needed to express itself so that I could understand what was happening to me spiritually.
Right, right. Well, I think it might be really important for people to realize who haven't done it, that these forms have a very particular physical form, structure, which you'd simply learn, but each one has a very precise and kind of poetic meaning, hence the mytho part of the somatic. And I think, you know, that's partly what captivated me. So it was never just, I don't know, you know, like the movement where you go up like this, and then you would say, and look up into the blue sky with wondrous eyes. you know, it was so kind of passionate.
That is, thank you. That is the word.
It was passionate. And you scoop it out of the yin muddy earth. And do you know what I mean? It was like so, just kind of, visceral. And that is a lot of what there was. It was never just automatic movements. These meanings that one had to visualize while doing the movement were so equal part of the process. Quite clearly,
hearing you say that is redemptive to me, both personally and pedagogically, because passion. You know, I went to Qigong to heal, and what I understood was a lesson that would eventually become post-Taoism and neo-romanticism. It took me decades to articulate that, but what I came to understand without consciously understanding it at that time was that these rote movements were not going to touch my particular need to express something, and that my own illness, which was chronic fatigue syndrome, needed to feel. I needed to feel what the Greeks call my daimon. I needed to feel the inmost angel of my being, which was emotional and which was a story that was unfolding. And it's exactly as you describe it. So in this sense, you're such a redemptive presence for me, because what you're telling me is that you loved it too, and you needed it. You needed it too. And that's when I began. The same thing happened with the philosophy of Taoism, which I know we're going to get into. I began to feel disingenuous, James, calling that Qigong, because passion is dangerous in traditional Chinese medicine often. You know, that it's something to be careful of.
Something might be out of balance.
Exactly. And balance is everything, and usually rooting and steadiness. And I think there's a real place for that. I mean, you know, when you first go to an acupuncturist and you have an illness, they'll tell you very important things like stop listening to rock music, loud music, and eat foods that are not dramatic in the assimilation and all of that. And I think that has a place. But for me, at least the way in which I interpreted the failure of my immune system had to do with a failure of intensity and proper passionate expression in my life. I was literally depressed physically, constitutionally, because I had an abundance of life force that needed its proper venues of expression, which I began to call mythos. And so my healing is directly engaged, and this is, you know, 35 years ago or whatever, my healing is directly engaged in actually not imagining that calmative and quietist practices were the answer. They were maybe the foundation, but as soon as there was any foundation, I became a neo-romantic without knowing it. I became someone who said, you know, I've started to follow your people, your Shelley and Byron, I didn't know it, but I thought that is going to be healing for me. And I think that's where you and I had a beautiful understanding, because you're a very passionate man.
Yes. And where, just give us a little, so when you had your chronic fatigue syndrome, what time of your life, where were you?
It lasted a very, very long time. It hit me early in my 20s, and then, and it's hard to, chronic fatigue, those listeners that have had anything like chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia or, you know, these mysterious kinds of things. It was, I mean, even when I was even when I was teaching in the late 90s, in Taos, I remember creating something that many of my students found beloved, which was, I called it Qigong in a teacup. And yeah. that was a clever way. And I don't mean clever in any disingenuous way, but that was a clever way of me being able to continue to teach when I had so little energy.
Right. I know. I remember doing it in a
teacup. You do. You do. Okay. That's sweet that you had that. And it's actually very profound for other people, but the beginning of that was actually stumbling into the Kit Carson Park in Taos, New Mexico, in, I don't know, somewhere between 90, 96 and 99, I guess. And being pale and tired even then. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a long journey, but it's certainly not the subject of my life. And at this point, you know, I have a Nietzschean capacity for amnesia around certain things, which I don't mean as denial, but I, you know, it's hard for me to remember that. And I think there's a certain spiritual intensity in facing the world. I remember, speaking of that time in Taos, I remember giving a lesson to a student that I was giving to myself. He had had a ski accident and he came to watch a class, and he had just gotten his cast off a few weeks ago, you know, and he was sitting next to me, and he, I can't demonstrate this physically, which I would like to do for the listener, but I'll try to do it verbally. He got up very slowly and he said, and he took him like, you know, 30 seconds to go from a seated position to a standing position. And I said to him what I think I had been saying to myself, which is, do you have to get up that way? I mean, what would happen if you just stood up? And he sat back down, and then he just stood up. And probably 5 years of healing happened in that willful amnesia. And you see what I'm saying? And he walked out of the door differently. And I began to understand that the way in which I disposed myself, I mean, not unintelligently, but nevertheless, the way in which I disposed myself physically and mentally toward experience would be a blueprint of how I would enter
that experience. Right. Okay.
Anyway.
And can you point to other, you say your sort of spiritual leaps, as it were, have tended to happen through crises. I know there's a fairly recent one, but can you allude to one or two others that would help people understand your path and where it's taken you?
Yes, and I want to define crisis. I haven't actually defined it. I define it many different ways, but I don't want anyone to misunderstand what I mean by that. I think that we'll get into my concept of the isos, which is a coinage to describe the blueprint of the soul. It's kind of like essence and eros as a compound word. And I think when I say crisis, what I mean is that you have this blueprint, you have this essence that you're born with, and it meets with circumstances that are inadequate to its fulfillment. And when that happens, there's a crisis, and we either capitulate and become what we're not in order to smooth out the difficulty of that incongruity, or we go down and dig into the essence itself, the esos, and we begin to sacrifice in relationship to that esos. We sacrifice, and isn't that what Heidegger called Daisan, right? I'm not sure of the pronunciation, but when you actually, it's the same dilemma that I think he describes, where you get to a certain point where you understand that civilization is fairly a sham of personalities that have decided to shave off their esos in order to assimilate and participate and often to make money. And so a crisis is for me the moment of truth, and they happen constantly, they happen almost daily, where the daimon, as the Greeks say, or esos, as I say, that original self must make powerful decisions as to whether it's going to be nourished, grown, and fortified, or cleverly tamped down and hidden from. So that's what I mean by a crisis, is that intersection.
Right.
And
right.
So it began...
Esos. So esos is essence meets eros.
Yes, but I mean eros in terms of the world, in terms of relationship. I don't mean it explicitly in terms of sexuality, though certainly that is a major part of the way we interact with the world. But I mean it that the way in which one's nature, one's essence, relates to eros, or the calling into relationship and responsibility, commitment, sacrifice, the combination of that is what a self actually is. So the esos is what we bring into the world of relationships through our essence. And yes, it begins in childhood. And you talked about asking me about these spiritual coordinates about a month or two ago, and I purposefully didn't even think about it until this morning. And then I scribbled a couple of things down, and I go in fear of these stories because they could take up hours, and I have to be very prudent about that, because I'm sure you have such scintillating questions to lead us on.
Which one springs out today?
I mean, there's a couple. I think what I would want, because I want to give homage to the soul, I think I would want to not be too grand with all of them and talk about how minute they can be. I mean, I remember as a child, driving with my parents to some city that was nearby. I think it was Baltimore. I think we went to dinner, and it was dusk, and we passed by a neighborhood that was, passed through a neighborhood that was not well to do. And I looked out the window, and there was a boy, and he must have been about 10 or 11, and he had a huge garbage bag over his shoulder, and he was taking it down the street, probably just putting it out, and he was staggering under the weight of it. And there was something about the gestalt of the impoverished street and the staggering boy and the weight which disappeared him, almost in a kind of Dante-esque image of travail and effort and perseverance against difficulty. And I was in the back seat of this car, just zooming by. And in that moment, I understood something about the world and the way my emotional self was related to effort and the will overcoming its circumstances. And I remember weeping in the back seat of the car and turning around. And, you know, a similar thing happened when I was driving in the car as well with my parents, and this will date me for everyone, they'll smile at my age, but there was a station wagon, a beaten up station wagon, in the lane just next to us and slightly advanced from our car. And there was a girl, also probably about the same age, and I was maybe a year or two younger. And I think I was in love with her immediately, you know, even speeding down the highway. And this was before seatbelts were absolutely the thing to do, you know, and back in the 70s. And her hair was black like my own, and it was streaming wildly and whipping all about her face. And I wrote my first poem to her. I said, "Girl, you can be the tail of the horse for the rest of your life." And then we zoomed onward. And so in that was the horse, which I would become enamored of. It was the girl, which was a a figure for my own transgender self and the kind of girl and woman that I needed to be. And it was a human projection of freedom and lack of tidiness. And I think the fancy French word is déshabille. She was so messed up. And I,
déshabillé, yeah.
How do you say it?
Déshabillé,
I think. Déshabillé, I don't know French. Thank you.
Oh, wow. And that was the, you think in retrospect, you were seeing the part of yourself.
Oh, I have a lot to say about that. I mean, I'm going to talk about that because that was a big part of my childhood. And then, I could go on and on. When I was a fellow at Stanford in poetry and teaching a course, I was offered what they call a Jones Fellowship. A Jones Lectureship. They still have this. And what that is an appointment for one of the six Stegner Fellows in poetry that they have each year, or every 2 years, actually. And so they appoint one of those six to stay on as an adjunct professor of literature and poetry. And I was given that that opportunity. And at the time, my job was to exercise the horses in the horse stables so that the PE students wouldn't get damaged. I made them docile for the physical education equestrian students. And so I had some favorite horses and I wasn't happy there. It was very difficult for me to be authentic or to feel a sense of authentic life in Palo Alto. It was so, the opportunity at Stanford was amazing, but it was also very hard to feel the grit of life, which is what I was associated with. And anyway, so I wasn't sure whether I would take this position. And I went and slept with my favorite horse in his stall. And so he would lay down in the stall, and I had never slept next to him in the stall, but I had gotten in there and caressed him after working hard and laid on his belly a few times in the afternoon. And so I wanted to go back because I wanted an animal intelligence to infuse this decision that I was making. And I ended up staying the night. And when I woke up, this is one of the stories that I wanted to tell. I woke up to the sound. I can actually do it because I have an anvil in the back here. I can make the sound. I wish you could see the anvil. It's behind the computer. Oh, we're not being visual. Anyway, I heard that sound and, it woke me up and I leaned out of the stall and looked down the gallery of the Stanford barn. It was about 5:30 in the morning. And the light was streaming in at a kind of mythopoetic angle. And there was a man, and he was shaping a horseshoe. Ooh. And he looked like a picture card. And in that moment, I knew that I wasn't going to accept the lectureship. And he was so beautiful in the way he was using his hands. And then I don't know if you or anybody listening has ever seen a horse hot shod, which means blacksmith instead of just nailed on cold, and you dip it after you finish it. It's red and you dip it in the quench bucket and it makes this sound and then steam rises everywhere. And I was leaning out the window having slept next to this beautiful creature. And it was so beautiful, James. And I walked down the gallery and said, quote, literally quote, what do you have to do to become that? And he said, you need a strong back. And then he said, then he paused and said, and then you've got to apprentice or you might want to go to school. And but that moment, leaning out of that, like life, this is what I mean. That was a crisis. The offer of the professorship at Stanford was a crisis. And I leaned out the stall door and looked down. And, in my mind, I hear a kind of beatific music playing, which, of course, there was none. And that's another example. Another one is very recently.
Well, maybe if I could just comment on that, because true of all of these, you know, in the car, in the wagon, the girl, the boy with the thing, with the rubbish, with the trash bag, the blacksmith with the horse, it's like these piercing moments, right? Because, you know, someone else could see that and there would just be no impact at all. And what I always associate you with, and I think this is a big part of your work, in fact, in the last course where I was listening to you, is about this sensibility. I mean, these moments will only happen, you know, if you're really there.
Yes.
If you're really sensitive, it's almost sort of Basho-like. You know, I'm sure you know Basho.
The frog, of course.
You know, it's like for anyone else, you're walking past a pond and you hear a frog in the distance. You know, it has no real depth. But for Basho, it's like it's created one of the most famous Japanese poems of all time, just the sound of a frog jumping in the water. So that's what it reminds me of, these moments. So this sensibility to not only the outer world and our inner response to it.
You give me help in describing the whole poetics and justification of my philosophy, because really it's a philosophy of sensibility through the shock of poetry. And by poetry, I don't mean a collection of words, but I mean a supersensate sensibility that is fragile in terms of what civilization has come to define toughness and sensitivity and fragility, meaning that the strong thing, the conventionally strong thing to do, I mean, Stanford was going to give me $85,000 a year back then to teach one class, one poetry class, which I would have done, which I would have paid to do, right? The strong thing to do would be to follow through with such an opportunity. But my constitution, and I'm using this word fragile in a very consciously sophisticated way, my sensibility is fragile enough, I think, to constantly hear crises as daimonic messages of direction in a life, because I literally never turned back from that moment. And when we get to talking about my so-called transition, it's exactly the same thing. The signs and the way, I mean, you can imagine it sort of like the cliche of thin skin. And if you imagine that if the skin is thin enough, the messaging is very clear, and it often looks capricious or even weak or.
But that's beautiful. I would like people to know, if the skin is thin enough, then the message becomes clearer. I mean, that's such a great way of seeing that.
Well, I think the whole world, I mean, your scope in this, in your podcast, from what I understand, is really spirituality, and obviously, and I do think, I don't mean to be simplistic, but if you look at the problems, whether they're individual problems of arrested development in human beings or holding on to wound in order to remain, blaming others in order not to grow, or if you look at nation states in the world we live in now, the skin thickens and the decisions are unreliable. the skin thickens. And I think, yes, I think you've really hit it on the head, with maybe my favorite word, which is sensibility. I mean, that's the book that I'm writing is about, you know, what would sensibility look like if it was centered and privileged as human power, as opposed to leverage and brute force as being human power? What would the world look like if sensibility was the great power? And so, just to give you another recent example. I would be remiss if I didn't speak about this kind of thing in terms of being the woman that I am. And I can relate one story to another. That girl in the station wagon, which was of course a figura, the Italians say figura, for my desire to be what I was even at that time. If you fast forward to a crisis that happened, 2013 or 14, someone plagiarized my forms and wrote a book about it. And a very famous New Age author. And I've never, ever defamed him for that, because I would never, ever in my life defame anyone publicly, no matter what they did. I would never speak poorly of anyone publicly, so no one knows his name and no one ever will. Because he was noble, too. In the end, he ended up taking that book completely out of his oeuvre and metaphorically burning all of the copies. But it happened like this. The publisher happened to be local up in Colorado. And what he did is he wrote this book, and he used all of my notes and took these mythosomatic forms, and he made a whole book about it. And he is a best-selling New Age author, very famous. And so I drove to the publisher and said, what can I do about this? These are the crises of my life, gone into gestural movement. And you need to know that you're publishing my work, and I don't know what to do about it. And she was very cool and unforthcoming during that 2-hour session of my tears. And I didn't think I had any effect, but I did. But because this person took the book completely off very nobly. But the spiritual part that I want to talk about is all that night, he's an angel, this man, this author is a great angel of mine, because all of that night in the hotel room, I was vomiting because he had taken 30 of my crises and made a book, and he was planning on going on a big tour. And so my identity, so I thought, had been stolen. And as I was leaning over the toilet, vomiting from pain, psychic pain, I asked myself, well, maybe he hasn't taken the most essential part of you. What hasn't he taken? And what he hadn't taken was that little girl in the station wagon who was me. He hadn't taken her. And so I knew in that moment of grief and pain that there was something that I had to do in terms of my gender. And I drove straight to the University of New Mexico hospital. And because I had this mythopoetic need/awareness that I needed to find out that there was something about my body that would indicate my femaleness. Ooh. And so I went to, and I got tested and said, I know that I have a chromosome that is misplaced. You've got to find it. And it's a very pathetic in the beautiful sense of the word pathos. And when I look back on that now, I have a tremendous sense of beautiful pathos and love for that person so desperately saying, you've got to find this chromosome. You've got to find it. I know that I'm not who I am. You've got to find it for me. And I just come from this other crisis of having my work plagiarized. And they came back and said, no, I'm sorry, you don't have, you have a male chromosomal makeup, but you are intersex hormonally. You have the estrogen, you have extremely high estrogen as well as extremely high testosterone. And I breathed a kind of sigh of relief, though I think I was weak in needing that justification. You know, I didn't actually need that justification, but I left the hospital and I began what they call a transition. So this is what I mean about crises and spirit. And I literally had an image of that girl in that station wagon who was me, and she was dying for me to have the courage to become her. And I followed her all of my life. And I want to stop speaking so you have a chance to comment. But the last story I do want to tell is the story of this shepherdess figure, which when I went into silence, I ended up following mythopoetically, literally all over the mountains. But I've been talking a while, and I love to hear what you have to say.
Wow. Yeah, it's... I think what most touches me is something that is becoming more and more important for me and how I see myself and life and my work is the narrative arc. You know, it's like it could be a book or it could be a symphony, you know, where you hear a refrain at the beginning, that then that refrain gets repeated at different times, and sometimes it'll be magnified and then go quiet and then magnified again. But the kind of, especially with the transition, I find that very moving. That girl that then reappears, but in such a, you know, in the traditional sort of, you know, sort of cheesy romantic story, you know, you'd meet her again or something and you'd fall in love, which you did, but it was the inner. And you know, I know you have quite a strong sort of Jungian background as well.
Mm-hmm. Very.
And so it's not surprising but in your case, that sort of anima or whatever we're going to call it has then actually needed, because you're such a body, such a somatic person, it actually needed to take physical form.
Oh.
And hence transition.
I think that's so beautifully understood that you know, what you're referring to, James, which I think a lot of your listeners may know, but some may not, is that Jung named the female spirit within a masculine consciousness, the anima. And I think there is something deeply, deeply spiritual for me about the truth of my transgender essence, in that that wasn't true for me, that it was the whole thing. And the process, that the anima was the essence. And that was there from the very beginning. And I do think that the Jungian breakdown has a lot of merit. I think it also has limitations. I think it helps people to be a little stagnant within their identification of their genders. They can say, in effect, oh, that's my feminine side doing this. And they can arrest their development. They can mete out or employ the anima to do certain things. And I think there can be danger in that in terms of personal development. But I also think there's value in those concepts. And for me, the anima needed to become the whole picture. And so yes, there's the continuity that you describe, I do believe, James, is the esos. And if you follow, and we'll finish up with this very rare catalog of self-reflexivity for Genevieve. It must be very special, James, to get this much self-reflexive narrative out of me. I'm very shy about those things. but I hope it has some use. But if you fast forward to a point fairly recently in my life, when maybe 2014, starting in 2013, 2014, when I began to really become incapable of the masculine presentation that had been a tragic form of will to power against the nature of that girl. And when I began to break down and lose the possibility of that performance, I knew that I had to stop speaking, because speech, because I hated my speech. I hated, there was no way to get out of the cadences, the patterns of maleness that had driven themselves into my speech. And I knew that speech was the way in which I was communicating my presentation and having it confirmed in existence. And I could not stand that hermeneutic any longer. And so the decision I made was to stop speaking in order to stop offending the Essos, which is that girl in this sense. I knew that every time I opened my mouth, James, I felt like I was offending her, because I was being someone that she was not. And I couldn't find a way, and which is interesting, it really pushes against Wittgenstein, right? And the limits of my language are the limits of my life, is a quote from Wittgenstein. And did I ever come ontologically, viscerally, face to face with that reality? And so I stopped speaking for 16 months, and I had about $90,000 in the bank from teaching. And I found a cabin that was $125,000 up in the Jemez Mountains. And I didn't know what my life was to become. And so I went in with a notepad. I wasn't speaking at the time. And I went in with a notepad and said, I'd like to see this cabin. And we went up to the cabin, and I wrote constantly my communications with the real estate agent. I slept there one night. She let me sleep in a sleeping bag on the bare floor, and she came and picked me up the next day. And I had her call the owner of the cabin, and I said, the truth is very powerful. I said, I have $90,000. I can't get a loan because I don't know what's going to happen to me after my transition. I may lose all of my students. I may have no way. Nobody may respect me anymore. I may be in the public eye a grotesque. I may lose everything. And so I don't want a mortgage, and I don't want to get a loan because I might be poor for the rest of my life. I don't know what's going to happen. And I need about $15,000 to start to eat. So will you accept $75,000? And I'm writing this down. I was actually typing it at that moment on a computer and handing it to my real estate agent to read it to the owner of the cabin. And there was a long pause, and she said, all right, you got it. So I bought this cabin, and I began to see the grown version of this wild girl in front of me as I was walking. And I called her the shepherdess. And because she was a mythological figure that I knew that I was in some other time, or would be even in this time. And I began a correlative of what Jung experienced in the sandbox after the break with Freud. Jung went into an atavistic, infantile phase, a beautiful infantile phase, where he began playing in the sandbox, trying to understand what had happened in the crisis with Freud. And I don't want to talk too much about that because I want to stay with my story. But I began a similar kind of pathetic and desperate infantile process by which every day I would walk, and I would follow her farther and farther, and I would start to really see her and smell her. And of course, she was the grown-up version of that wild and free girl in the station wagon, who of course was myself. And I followed her and followed her. And this went on for a year. I didn't speak at all for 16 months, and I didn't have any technology, any devices for a year. And during that discipline, she became extremely prominent to the point where, of course, anyone listening would wonder if I thought I was going mad. And that begs the question of what madness is, because I was desperate to get closer and closer to her until the image I had was that she would permit me to walk into her back. And at that point, when she did that, I could become her, and I could walk down the literal and proverbial mountain and re-enter society again. And that's what happened, though it wasn't that clean. The moment of becoming her wasn't that instant. Mm-hmm. It was much harder, but it did happen. And eventually I did come down the mountain. I went to the Smith's grocery store in Los Alamos without my notepad 16 months later. And the woman said to me, how are you? And she had gotten very used to me writing notes, you know. And I said, it's really good to see you. And she fell down at the cashier. And she said, I thought you were a mute, you know. I thought you could speak. But the following of that woman who is the self, the literalization of it, I think that that's what you're talking about. And that's what I mean about poetry and ontology in my particular biography becoming indivisible. And this is why I cannot be a teacher, a coach, or a self-help teacher. This is why I have to be a philosopher, because nothing in my own life can be recommended in the form of, yes, in the form of advice.
Yes, it's got some extreme elements to it.
Right.
But also what strikes me, Zhen, with your stories is that you sound so alone at it all. I mean, without any reference figures, you know, it's not like you immediately went online and tried to find other people with gender dysphoria, or it's not like you had a particular teacher or friend. I mean, it's incredible trust. I mean, you mentioned Socrates's daimon. So you had an incredible trust in your daimon. And maybe you even thought if you consulted others too much or whatever, that you maybe you would lose the clarity of your daimon. But it sounds so incredible and brave, but also quite a lonely process.
You're right. You're right. And I think I haven't had company in that process until recently, with my companion Willa, who is in love with the Essos to such an extent that it's redemptive across the whole biography of my loneliness. But yes, you are correct about that. And I never did consult with any other trans people. Ooh. Not one. I think...
But even back to with the decision with the between Stanford, the Post, and the horse, it doesn't sound like you called up your friends, hey, let's have a beer,
no,
because I want to discuss, you know, I want to discuss next moves, or you call mum and dad, and you know, it's a, you have a very strong kind of, that sort of, I don't know, destiny type.
I suppose, and I'm a little shy about pronouncing this because it, I don't want any self-aggrandization to come into the way in which I represent myself to myself or to others. But I suppose there is a gritty truth to what you're saying, which is that I don't trust civilization to guide me.
Yeah.
I don't. I know the kind of voices that generally come in all of those crises. The voices say, take this year at Stanford. Mm. It's an incredible opportunity. You can always become a blacksmith, but you can't always seize the moment here.
Mm.
The voices say, you know, go on a retreat. You don't need to go into silence for 16 months, for God's sake. Go on a retreat. Go do a vipassana. Get in touch with your inner self that way. The voices are not bad voices. They're sane voices. I suppose if I was to be brutally honest, and you're really having me, cajoling me to speak in ways, James, that are probably reflection on some way in which I trust your intentions in being an interlocutor with me. I must trust them because I'm being very honest about something. I think any poet, any philosopher would probably have to blur the lines between sanity and insanity that the civilization has constructed. And I don't think I'm rare in that understanding, you know, meaning there has to be, when you're following the Essos, when the wings of the daimon are so immediately available to you, your actions are unreadable by the given culture. Mm. And I do not know exactly where the so-called strength to adhere to that comes from, except for a feeling of grief that so much of humanity has missed its magnificence, and so many people have jettisoned the pith of their truth and their beauty. I think growing up in a world where there is so much spiritual failure in terms of actually claiming an awesome and magnificent existence, that I think I could not bear and cannot bear to capitulate to that, almost as if there's a moral responsibility toward authenticity, toward radical being, as if I owe it to the gift of human nature itself to not capitulate.
Yeah. I mean, it's gotta, and I was thinking that because I was looking at your website today and reading your credo.
Mm.
And it's definitely gotta, I'm sure there are certain ways you don't want to be sort of related to him, but it's got a slightly Nietzschean aspect to it.
Well,
you know, this absolute determination not to follow slave morality.
Yes.
Which I understand as sort of slave convention, and to risk being alone in something, and his whole concept of amor fati, of loving your fate, your destiny. There's a very strong echo there, I would say. Even his bit of Superman, which has been, I think, very misunderstood in many ways.
Oh, the Superman is tragically misunderstood and associated with Nazi indifference.
No,
which is astonishing, and that happened through his sister Elizabeth, who was allied with a radical anti-Semite and Forster. his name was. And I mean, to the point that he wanted to like colonize an Aryan place, I think in South Africa or something. And, you know, but yes, Nietzsche's dangerous. He's a dangerous, hyper-masculine, misogynistic, blindly action-based philosopher. And I say that with my left hand. And with my right hand, James, he saved my life. His philosophy, his philosophies of self-determination, he calls it self-overcoming.
Right.
He says something that could be, that could wipe the whole modus operandi of this beautiful interview we're having. He says one thing. He says, how much? It's an exclamation. I think it's in Beyond Good and Evil, in one of his aphorisms. He says, how much do I owe my illnesses?
Mm.
It's a direct quote from the Kaufman translation. And he taught me what, I mean, nobody teaches us anything, right? We just are reminded the precision of what we have instincts for.
Right.
And
yes. And of course, I mean, William James also had a slightly similar thing there with his illnesses and how he somehow managed to kind of use his will to confront them and go through them. And that also came to mind as you were speaking just then.
Well, William James is also, in fact, I'm actually rereading The Varieties right now.
Oh, it's a fantastic book.
Oh, it's a book. It's a book to always come back to for me. But Nietzsche's problem is semantic, and his semantics are constitutional. He calls it the will to power. I would call it the will to sensibility.
Right.
And you could imagine that the book that I'm writing on post-Taoism and neo-romanticism could actually be called the will to sensibility. And that seems almost like a contradiction in terms, because we've been brainwashed by Nietzsche to imagine that will has to do with domination rather than apperception. Sensibility is a function of apperception, right? Which is allowing phenomenon and ideation and sensuality to fall upon you and become you.
Mm.
So the act of will is displaced toward an ultra sensitivity. And so my will toward sensibility would not be a figure of force. It would be a conviction not to capitulate to easy tropes of convention, so that I can feel what I have to become and how I have to face and transform.
And how do you balance that with, I mean, you've referred to it a little bit there with the sort of self-determination, but of course, a lot of people associate, you know, especially with all the literature on hypersensitive individuals, it's this sensitivity with, oh, I can't take too many stimuli and I have to protect myself and I can't put myself in that context and I can't put myself in that context. And there's something, I don't know, that does not seem to be what you're talking about there. I mean, I'm not saying we would never protect ourselves, but how would you distinguish, or how within that intense sensibility, will to sensibility, I love that, how do you also keep, so you feel everything, you're sensitive to things, but you're not sort of, maybe you are not always knocked off balance, because that's part of the story too. But you see, but there's also in you, how I've known it, there's a steadiness in you.
I think this is why, this is why I seem to naturally disposition myself almost ahistorically, philosophically, in the sense that I don't believe that a supra sensate being is actually unstable. That is a historical concretization that has been decided in the collective unconscious. And I actually would go beneath that and say, and this is what I perceived as a child and growing up, the people that presented to me as stable, I could read into them even as they were adults and I was a child, James. I could see that they were lying to themselves about almost everything. And they didn't seem stable to me, even though they had a demeanor of stability or conventional success. And so I think moving toward an indivisibility with the esos, with a daimon,
right,
as an ontological potential, is not going to look stable in this society and in almost any contemporary society. I think in indigeneity, I'm sure there were places where that was confounded. Strength and stability were much more allied.
Indigenous people, you mean?
Yes, yes. Yeah, exactly. With sudden inspirations, the way I had an inspiration to go become a blacksmith in that moment of being offered the post. And yet, I think what's important to share about this is that I'm poor right now. Relatively speaking, in my life, I'm not poor in terms of the world's poverty. But there are ups and downs in the life, the sacrifices that are engendered. I have very few friends. I lost 80% of a student body through my transition. Men in particular that had an interface with me as a role model of masculinity. On and on, the sacrifices of following a daimonic impulse, I think, are increasingly too intimidating and too formidable for the contemporary consciousness. I think the kind of person that I am was much more common in the 1800s than it is now.
Yeah, I mean, but also the stakes can be high. I mean, clearly Socrates is daimon, and Jesus Christ basically said yes to their own execution.
Yes, I mean, if you look at
both of them, could have got out of it.
If you look at anybody who is doing that, look at Martin Luther King, look at Frederick Douglass, look at Zora Neale Hurston, look at the people that you mentioned. I'm not putting myself in their category, but I'm putting myself in the ethos of self-determination.
Right.
And sacrifice, I think there's a beautiful semantic flip when we come to this kind of existential disposition, which is that the word sacrifice loses its bitter teeth. There's almost no such thing. Because one is in the grip of these instincts, come what may, and one has a sense that no matter what happens, the articulation and the emotional disposition toward truth is the only thing that matters. And so it's hard to even talk about sacrifice. But I just mention it because I know that the relationship, I mean, I think, and this might be an interesting segue, you mentioned loneliness and aloneness. The daimon cannot be heard without aloneness. And these days, we live in a constant state of warfare against the power of aloneness. And people have less and less of a knowledge and a relationship to aloneness, because there is every kind of feed on Instagram and social media and all kinds of buying options and all kinds of news. And all, I mean, people are ripped out of the disposition toward life that would give them a keener ear toward their essos. And that's actually engineered by the society, because, I mean, you mentioned Socrates and Jesus, right? The more one attunes, the more radical one might become and the more disruptive to the way things are. And that's certainly been the case with me in my own small way in comparison. But yeah, it's a similar conviction that does come from Nietzsche as well, that amor fati, which I mention in every third class I teach.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know you.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I often do too. Well, listen, Jen, I think what I would like to do is, because I mean, I'm also very moved by this whole dialogue we've had. It's been so deeply personal. And of course, it's mainly been about your person, but all sorts of personal things have been going on inside me, which I'm digesting. But I think what I would like to do, and we mentioned this before, was I'd like us to close it off now, because it has been so personal. And maybe do one more podcast where we can sort of zoom out a bit, just as you were beginning to do there, to some,
if you promise,
like state of the society.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I've always been wanting to ask you, also why you see that trans people are kind of cultural pioneers. So take it a bit more out to the sort of social and state of the world. I mean, I always like to start with the personal, but I think we should save that for the next podcast, if you're up for it.
Well, I'm actually asking you to make that a promise, because otherwise, if this is all there is, I will feel very vulnerable, very self-absorbed, and a little ashamed of that much self-reflexivity. So I beg you to follow through with that, because it's an inversion on the way in which I've talked to anyone in these kinds of circumstances. Usually I tell people beforehand, you know, we live in a memoir, you know, kind of an Oprah Winfrey me-ism storytelling, you know, time. I know, and you're not anything like that. But, and Oprah, you know, for her part, has done some wonderful things.
Yeah.
But I beg you to follow through with that, so that I don't feel vulnerable and exposed as a person obsessed with their own stories, because that's not the truth, my nature.
And just to say, I don't in the slightest, and I don't think anyone else will, there's nothing remotely self-indulgent about it. I mean, it's really just sharing on a very deep level, and I think it can really touch people, inspire them. And so will already be a social impact of what you've revealed today. So don't worry about that.
Okay. I mean, I think I just want to compliment you before we close, and saying that there must be an estuary of your tenderness and your intelligence that allows me to feel like the stories matter. Ooh. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Jen. Well, I'm going to stop the recording, and we're going to join soon, I hope. But thanks so much for the.
Are we not recording now? Are we?
Oh, we're still recording.
We're still recording.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, bye. Bye, bye. See you next time.